In the last week, many of us have been exploring gratitude. We explored it before the Qigong and sitting. We explored it afterwards. Many of us, again, explored it in our practice last week. The talk last time was on the theme of gratitude. I wanted to review that a little bit, where we went. And I'd love to hear in the discussion how your practice of gratitude evolved, opened things up, led to insights. How many remembered and kept on with a focus on gratitude in the last week? Okay, great. So there's room for discussion. So I want to briefly review some about gratitude, add some pieces to it that I didn't bring in last time, and then take us into some related but different territory, the identity of which will remain a secret until we get there. So the suspense is building. Okay. So again, thanks to Sarah for bringing up that Pali notion of katanuta, which some of you know. There's the so-called gratitude hut at Spirit Rock, which has that term. And again, gratitude is this sense of having some movement in the heart related to what we've received. I like to interpret it as a form of mudita, where we're grateful and in a sense tuned in to what is good in our lives and what has been good, what we have received, what is going well. It's a kind of tuning into the happiness and joy that we experience. And can be, again, a wonderful regular practice that can be especially helpful for those of us who tend to be overly critical. Show of hands? Overly critical, or have what the psychologists call the negativity bias well developed and prominent. And so, interestingly, there's been a lot of research on gratitude. A lot of it's come out of UC Davis. And it's very, very interesting. The research is quite stunning in a way. One researcher whose name, Dr. Dural Swamy, head of the Division of Biological Psychology at Duke, said that if gratitude were a drug, it would be the world's best-selling product with a health maintenance indication for every major organ system. But when you practice gratitude, it helps with these parts of our experience. It helps with the mood neurotransmitters, serotonin and norepinephrine. It helps with reproductive hormones. It helps with social bonding hormones. It helps with cognitive and pleasure-related neurotransmitters. Did you know that? Some of you did. It helps the inflammatory response. It helps with the immune system. It helps with stress hormones. It helps with cardiac and EEG rhythms. And it helps with blood pressure and blood sugar. Doing just a little bit of gratitude, and some of the research they've done is kind of stunning, where they have done research, you know, and had a control group not doing regular remembrance of things one's grateful for, and another group doing something like what we did with gratitude practice, simply a small amount of time every day remembering what one's grateful for, tuning into where there's gratitude. And here are some of the results of one of the tests. After 10 weeks, participants who were in the gratitude group as opposed to the control group reported feeling better about their lives as a whole than the other group. They were 25% happier. by some measurements of happiness. They reported fewer health complaints, and they exercised 1.5 hours more. Grateful people tend to take better care of themselves, engage in more protective health benefits and behavior like exercise and good diet, lower levels of stress, and so forth. So some of us may want to continue beyond 1 week. Those results were reported after 10 weeks. So very, very interesting. And again, there are ways that this regular development of gratitude can really open up the heart and be something that we becomes more a way that we are in a number of circumstances. We can have that sense of gratitude that can get expressed in relationships, sometimes as appreciation at work and so forth, and it changes things. I know for myself, receiving gratitude and appreciation from people with whom I just have regular relationships can really shift the dynamics and can really build a certain sense of connection. Very relevant for next week, the development of Sangha. Can have a gratitude expression, just like Corey essentially, among other things, was expressing gratitude, was expressing it openly. And we looked last time also at how gratitude can be even there with what's difficult. That we can have a sense of gratitude that even emerges in a difficult phase. And I looked at that some last time. I wanted to read two things. One is, this is probably well known, this is the Rumi's The Guest House, which probably many of you know well. It's essentially about gratitude for whatever comes, partly because we don't know, even though we think we do, we don't know why things are happening sometimes. We don't know. We have a certain narrative, but the poem is really suggesting that we keep broadening the narrative, even to have a place potentially for gratitude for what is difficult. So this being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. There's a quality of gratitude there. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. That guest may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And then another kind of poem. This is from Billy Mills. Some of you may know Billy Mills was a Native American who I think was the first person from the U.S. to win one of the long-distance races at the Olympics. And he won, I think, 1964. And you can go back. I looked on YouTube, and it's really like a powerful video of his winning. I think it was the 10,000 meters. Again, first person from, yes, usually that's the province these days of people from Kenya often, and used to often be more the Europeans who could do that well. And this is a poem from his book. It's about gratitude in the face, because actually his life after he won had many difficulties. And this is from his book. It's called Wokini, New Life. Again, he was Native American. Listen for the quality of gratitude in the midst of challenge. In my youth, I respected the world and life. I needed not anything but peace of heart. And yet I changed despite myself, and I believed in Iktumi's lies. Iktumi seemed to know all the truth. He promised to make me happy. He made me ask Wakantanka for wealth that I might have power. I was given poverty that I might find my inner strength. I asked for fame so others would know me. I was given obscurity so I might know myself. I asked for a person to love that I might never be alone. I was given the life of a hermit that I might learn to accept myself. I asked for power that I might achieve. I was given weakness that I might learn to obey. I asked for health that I might lead a long life. I was given infirmity that I might appreciate each minute. I asked Mother Earth for strength that I might have my way. I was given weakness that I might feel the need for her. I asked to live happily that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might live happily. I received nothing I asked for, yet all my wishes came true. Despite myself and Iktumi, my dreams were fulfilled. I am richly blessed, more than I ever hoped. I thank you, Wakantanka, for what you have given me. And that last line in the poem really points to the area I want to explore further, which is that gratitude is very commonly related to a sense of having received the generosity of others and the generosity of the earth. So there's a very close relationship. And again, Sarah was reflecting both on dana and generosity and on gratitude. So I wanted to explore more the notion of generosity and again ask and invite everyone to maybe continue, if you wish, the practice of gratitude if you want to get some of those 10-week benefits. Could be other motivation. But also consider bringing in also a practice of generosity and see how they're related. And I think it's helpful to, in our approach, to explore generosity as much more than financial generosity. Especially if we do retreats or go to retreats, or for me, I lead retreats. I'll speak for myself. I give talks on dana, so-called dana talks, which are primarily about financial support. And I do those probably 20 to 40 times more than I give actual talks on generosity, exploring that theme in its depth. And so that's what I wanted to do more. I think it's important that we have that sense of dana as a core practice, and only in part having to do with material dimension. So the relationship between gratitude and generosity, this is from a Zen teacher named Steve Stuckey, who taught at Zen Center. Anyone know Steve Stuckey? Yeah, he died 6 years ago, fairly young. He said, "The spirit of giving is based upon a feeling of gratitude, of being deeply thankful for the ability to give and to receive, and to be freely willing to participate in the reciprocal turning of life energy." So ultimately, dana is really, and this is how it's explored in some settings, it's really about the understanding that's there in a number of traditions, especially native tradition, that the gift keeps moving, that there's a sense of continual giving. And in fact, I was thinking of times that I've been brought into, particularly the native communities in British Columbia. I have a friend who took me in, and I went to a large potlatch ceremony. It's essentially a gift-giving ceremony. And there's a notion of the gift that keeps moving. And there, I was there for 7 days. The potlatch itself took place for 3 days. And by the way, the potlatch was outlawed by the British. It was outlawed by the British, but then by the Canadians, under the influence of the missionary who thought that giving gifts on a large scale was not moral. Okay, I won't. No commentary on that. And so it actually was outlawed from 1881 to 1951. And I went to the ceremony, and it was this continual giving of gifts. Everyone gave gifts, everyone received gifts. And then there were ceremonies where special gifts were given by one particular family, and the family that was giving the gifts was actually the family that invited me to be there in the ceremony. And I received gifts, and there were 3 days of essentially ceremony and gift giving. Started about 3 p.m, went till 3 or 4 a.m, when people slept in. Right? And but the understanding was that the giving and receiving is a continual cycle. And so, again, that can be a very strong basis for community. We can maybe bring that theme in next week. This is from the Buddha. These two people are hard to find in the world. Which two? The one who is first to do a kindness. That would be the generosity piece. The one who is first to do a kindness, and the one who is grateful and thankful for a kindness done. Closely related. One is hard to find who gives. One is hard to find who is grateful. Interesting. Even in that culture, not easy to find. And I believe that these qualities of generosity and gratitude, in obvious and not so obvious ways, they cut through what would be called the three poisons. You know, the core dynamics that lead to dukkha, suffering, reactivity, greed, hatred, and delusion. And we can see that generosity is an antidote to greed. And there are different ways to practice, you know. One simple way to practice is to commit to doing 1 or 2 or 3 generous acts a day. They don't have to be big acts. They can just be, you know, calling up a friend who is not well, or, you know, offering something to someone in need. And I'll come back to other ways to practice that can be helpful, but it's clear that some kind of generosity goes against a sense of greed. It goes against that wanting or wanting for myself. It can also go against hatred. You know, it's, you know, some of you may remember one of the practices that I think I learned from Joseph Goldstein was to give a gift to someone with whom one has some problems. It's very hard to maintain hostility if you give a gift to someone with whom you have some tension or problems. Of course, it could be interpreted cynically, right? But it's really, really what's there in the heart. And of course, gratitude also goes against the tendency to different forms of reactivity negatively. You know, that pushing away, being judgmental, outright hatred. That the gratitude can counter that. As I was saying earlier, it can go against the negativity bias. It's very hard to maintain, again, some of our negative views if we partake of gratitude and generosity. And I think it also related to what I was saying earlier written in relation to potlatch. It goes against delusion, the sense that I need to pile up stuff for myself, and goes against the reality of interdependence, that it can really be a deep practice to help us to understand more that sense of interdependence. Really, really crucial, you know, in relationship to our times, to develop that sense of interdependence and mutual need. So I think most of us know that generosity is one of the 10 paramis, that it's very, very central for the Buddha. And it's said that when the Buddha was giving talks on the entire path, he would almost always start by talking about generosity. This is foundational. That in places where he did that, he would always go to talking about generosity first. And it's the list of the paramis, you know. Generosity comes number one. For us, it's probably an advanced practice. But in the Asian context, it's a beginning practice. One learns generosity young. It's a deep value for virtually every culture will value generosity. And it's interesting to listen for some of the etymologies of the word. In the Jewish tradition, there's a standard guideline that one gives 10% of one's income to those in need. That's the guideline. How much do you give? How much do I give? I don't think it's 10%, right? But that's a guideline that's used. And the very word in Hebrew for generosity is tzedakah. And it's connected with words that connote justice and righteousness. And in the Christian tradition, the word that we generally connect with generosity is charitas, from which the word charity comes. But do you know where the word charity comes from? And the word charitas in Latin? It's actually a translation from of agape from the Greek. So essentially, the word for generosity in Christian tradition is related to unconditional love. Isn't that interesting? So we have justice, righteousness. These are the deeper understandings of these cultures. In Islam, generosity is called zakat. It's one of the five pillars of Islam. And it's related to words meaning purification. So again, I think in especially the way we do the Dana talks, generosity is a little bit of an afterthought, isn't it? The real action is with mindfulness, maybe loving kindness. And I think in many ways, because of the emphasis on meditation in Western Buddhism, I think we neglect qualities like generosity and gratitude. We neglect a lot of the paramis, you know, because we have that, I would say, an overemphasis on meditation. I bristle sometimes when people ask me what I do, and I say, well, I'm a meditation teacher. I don't think that's quite right. But I don't, you know, Dharma teacher needs translation. That's more accurate. Right? But again, we focus so much on meditation. Of course, meditation is beautiful, wonderful, but I think we lose something in the way the emphasis has been so much on meditation. I can see that with generosity, because I think we treat generosity as a kind of an afterthought sometimes, or a second level practice, or what you do at the end of a retreat. You practice Dana, right? This is from Dorothy Day talking about the earthquake of 1906. She grew up in Oakland. And she wrote about the intense generosity that was there after the earthquake. And in fact, we could see that after most crisis situations, the level of generosity is incredible. This is what she said. What I remember most plainly about the earthquake, she was 8 years old when the earthquake occurred, was the human warmth and kindness of everyone afterwards. For days, refugees poured out of burning San Francisco and camped in Idora Park and the racetrack in Oakland. Mother and all our neighbors were busy from morning to night cooking hot meals. They gave away every extra garment they possessed. They stripped themselves to the bone in giving, forgetful of the morrow. While the crisis lasted, people loved each other. Very telling comment, of course, right? While the crisis lasted, people loved each other. And they got back to normality. So there's something deep. You can hear in that story the deeper resonance of generosity, that it really has to do with a kind of love, that has to do with understanding interdependence and interconnection, that has to do with doing what is right. So again, it's not something so small. It's really connected with these deeper values. We can see it in that example, I think. Where there's less of a sense of interdependence, as there often is in our culture, there's less generosity, I think. John O'Donohue said, "A generous heart is never lonesome. A generous heart has luck. The lonesomeness of contemporary life is partly due to the failure of generosity." Of course, there's a lot of generosity in the culture, but, you know, oftentimes not so much. So the Buddha wanted there to be the practice of generosity in every moment that someone who was a monk or a nun lived. One could not really live without receiving daily the food for the day from others. That he worked generosity and, we would presume, gratitude even into the daily round of experience. We find that sense of generosity not just in the paramis taught by the Buddha, we find it also in the Mahayana tradition as one of the perfections. It's one of the qualities of a bodhisattva, one who is dedicated both to awakening and to helping others. Here's a passage about the bodhisattva and generosity. "When the bodhisattva gives an external object, the bodhisattva gives whatever is needed to whomever stands in need of it. And knowing by oneself that someone is in need of something, one gives it even unasked, much more when asked. One gives sufficiently, not insufficiently, when there is something to be given. One does not give because one expects something in return. When there is not enough to give sufficiently to all, one distributes evenly whatever can be shared. One does not give things that issue an affliction for others, such as weapons, poison, and intoxicants. Nor does one give amusements which are harmful and lead to negligence. One does not give unsuitable food or drink to a person who is sick, even though that person might ask for it. One does not give what is suitable beyond the proper measure." And it's said there's a threefold purity of giving and generosity. There's a purity in oneself, there's a purity of the recipient, and there's a purity of the act of giving. So all of these are areas where one practices. One looks in giving at the motivation. What's my motivation in giving? Am I looking for recognition? Am I looking for something in return? And in some of the passages on generosity, there's a list of all the ways that generosity can go wrong. Wanting something in return, doing it for self-image, you can imagine what the others are. So we want to look at the intention in generosity. You know, what's there? What's there for me? One of the texts, it says, look for these possible distortions of generosity. One may give sometimes to someone with annoyance as a way of offending the recipient. One may give because of fear. One may give in return for a favor done in the past, not the true spirit of generosity, more of an exchange relationship. One may give with the hope of getting a similar favor in the future. One may give because giving is considered good for self-image or reputation or because of what others will think. When One may give to get a good reputation, and so forth. We may give for favoritism. Again, anyway, there's a long list. You get the sense. So how to practice generosity? In the tradition, it said that there are different kinds of gifts. There are material gifts. There are gifts that are helpful to others in other ways. And it says the greatest gift actually is the gift of Dhamma, the gift of the teachings of liberation. And again, we can interpret that both as a formal teaching, but I think in some ways we give ourselves to others. We give ourselves, if the teachings are alive, our own being is a kind of a gift. That's one way to look at it. What does it mean to give the gift of the Dhamma? So we can take on the practice of giving. Make a vow for a week. Maybe you want to do this. I will have one generous act a day, or three, or five. And again, they can be very small, but you don't go to sleep until you've done them. You have to call at a late hour or do something generous. But you could take that on. Listen as I speak of some ways of practicing. What resonates with you? What would you like to take on? Again, in all the acts of giving, looking at motivation and intention, really, really crucial. See when there's some of those possible distortions. I sometimes drive with generosity in mind. You can bring generosity to all sorts of activities. Can I bring generosity to driving? Yes, please. Cut right in front of me. It actually helps a lot when I actually bring generosity to driving. Forgiveness also often comes with it. One can bring a certain amount of money and go in town, and if people ask, give something away, or give money away, or bring food with you for people who need food. They did one test where they gave one control group $50 and said, spend it on yourselves. They gave another control group $50, give it to others, and they found that there was much more happiness with the second group. It's interesting that, again, to feel oneself in this web of giving and receiving is to feel a deep sense of belonging with the web of life, we might say. And so it's, again, I think not a small practice. Not a small practice can take one into that sense of the wisdom of understanding interdependence. We can develop generosity in our families, in our workplaces. What would it mean to have more generosity in this institution, in my family? What would it mean? What might we do? Let's see. So see if any of these resonate as a way of practicing. Again, the key is to have a focus on generosity in some small or big way each day, if we want to do it for a practice for a week. And then just watch what comes up. Watch the intentions, bring the mindfulness, see what's there. And it can, again, be a way of working with greed, hatred, and delusion very directly. So let me finish with a short reading from the Buddha. And what is the treasure of generosity? There is the case of a disciple of the noble ones, one's awareness cleansed of the stain of stinginess, living at home, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in being magnanimous, responsive to requests, delighting in the distribution of alms. This is called the treasure of generosity. So I know, and for me, in teaching on this, it's really expanded my understanding. Again, we have tendencies to think of generosity and even gratitude as secondary practices, but I think you can see that having that spirit of generosity, there are more and more during the day, and the practices just help that, can really lead one to live in that sense of interdependence, you know, and live in the sense of being in a world in which one is giving and receiving. There's generosity and there's gratitude. And one can remember, I think a reading I gave last week from Thomas Merton was about, he saw his daily practice as one of praise for this cycle of generosity and gratitude. Praise for this aspect of life, that both can be there. Let me stop there and invite a moment of quiet and reflection. If some of this exploration of generosity and gratitude resonated with you, what do you feel called to explore in the next week? How might you practice generosity? If you've been practicing gratitude, you want to continue that for another week, maybe adding generosity to it. If that feels like too much, but you still want to do one of the practices, see what calls you. So, can open things up. I'd love to hear any gratitude stories, learnings, insights, revelations, poems that came out of the week.
I was having a conversation with my youngest son, and he had somebody did identity theft in him, and he was in the process of dealing with that, and we were having a conversation, you know, about that, and we're talking about it. He and I have had discussions in the past about radical gratitude, and he said that he felt pissed. Right? Yeah. Because it happened. It was just a pain to take care of it. But he said there was a part of him that was feeling very badly for this person. Because he thought about, well, first of all, he said the thing that they used his identity to purchase and stuff, he said that was just really sad. He said it was a really sad thing. Yeah. And I said, yeah. So you could be kind of, so we talked about being grateful that this was not, you were not that person. That you were not in that person's place, and just how no matter how unpleasant what you're going through is, that this person's life probably is a heck of a lot more sad and empty than yours is, and to have gratitude for the things that you had, and it led to this really nice conversation that we had about that, about the things that how I mean. My life is good, not like perfect, but I have so much to be grateful for every day. Yeah. And it was lovely that he and I could have that conversation.
That's quite.
He's a lawyer in New York City.
Yeah, so not always so common. Yeah, to to have the mind go there, right? That, again, it's what we're really pointing to in part, is that the, you know, our training, our practice, hopefully gives us some access to the, what we might call the awakened heart in difficult situations. I heard compassion, I heard some gratitude coming out of a painful and potentially complex, difficult situation. And our practice really prepares us for that, that we might have more resources to have the heart be there even with a really difficult situation, whether it's gratitude or generosity or compassion or equanimity. You know, I just actually came from teaching 2 days on the Brahmavihara. We were looking into the place of the heart practices, including with difficulty. So it's a beautiful story. Thank you.
I just wanted to share the acts of generosity in the last fires that happened.
Mm-hmm.
People had to evacuate in Sonoma County, essentially from Santa Rosa all the way to the coast.
Yeah.
And so there were 3 centers in Petaluma for these people who came. And there were several thousand people that showed up in Petaluma.
Mm.
Parts of Petaluma had power and parts didn't. But the thing that happened was that the people who came may not have had any cash. ATMs didn't work and credit cards didn't work.
Mm.
And so if you went into a restaurant, because I didn't have power, you wanted a cup of coffee and you didn't have the cash, mm. numbers of restaurants would say, don't worry about it. I mean, they offered food, coffee, whatever. If you didn't have the money, you couldn't charge it with a credit card, you couldn't get cash. And the businesses in Petaluma was really, really happy to see how much generosity to people who were in need. It's like you said, if you have a crisis, people come through in really unusual ways. And it happened in this
That's beautiful.
Thing.
Beautiful really story, yeah, beautiful
and
account.
People, all the people who were, you know, the evacuees,
yeah.
Felt really good about it, I mean, as far as I could tell.
Yeah. Yeah, how many have had personal experience with crises in which you felt that spirit of generosity, the energy of generosity? Probably almost all of us, yeah. You know, and there's a book I probably mentioned from time to time. It's the quote from Dorothy Day came from it. Rebecca Solnit wrote a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, which was a study of people's response in crises. And she went against the prevailing view that in crises you have to look out because people will, you know, people will be out for themselves and civil order will break down and so forth. And she found the complete opposite. And she looked mostly at natural disasters like earthquakes and, you know, could be the rains and the power outages. But she looked at a number of things. She also looked at 9/11. And she found that almost universally people came through in ways that went against the message of the authorities, look out, that there was tremendous generosity, giving, and virtually no crime, you know, in those situations. I remember I talked with people who said after 9/11 was the time that they felt it was the most beautiful time to be in New York. Maybe some of you were there, but it was so much generosity was there. So I think those stories are important to hear, aren't they?
about these subjects this time of year.
Yeah.
Because I think if I'm thinking about what practice will I have for generosity, I think part of it will be reminding myself to be grateful for the opportunity to be generous. Mm-hmm. We've been, my husband and I are doing Christmas dinner, and the list keeps expanding, and my reaction has been, oh, no, not more people. And now, wait a minute, we're supposed to be enjoying this, and there's enjoyment there.
Yeah.
Why not enjoy generosity?
Yeah.
So I really thank you for reminding
me. That's great. Thank you. And the key is we remember that these are all practices, right? That's the key. It's not about sort of, oh, now I'm just generous, I do that. But rather, we intend generosity, and then we watch the mind. Mm-hmm. We watch what comes up. That's what makes it a practice. Yeah.
So I was just going to say, some of us have problem practice. We need to practice being generous with ourselves.
Mm.
And I know I need to remind myself of that. And I had an experience recently where I got to practice a lot of giving of time, energy, money, my home, mm-hmm. etc. To people I actually didn't know.
Mm.
And it was exhausting.
Yeah.
But it was in alignment with my values and I felt grateful for it.
Mm.
And then I had to give myself the generosity of laying low.
Mm.
And I just took a few days and didn't get out of bed. And it was delightful. And I didn't read sutras, I did crossword puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful. So sometimes I need to remember that. To include, Yvonne Rand once said to me, when you're busy being kind to other people, remember to include yourself.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, no, it's anyone who wants to amend your intention for the next week's generosity practice on the basis of that suggestion, feel free. I think it's really, really crucial. And it's also about, what really is a deeper need, right? Really, even going deeply in terms of that generosity. Yeah. Thanks for that. Any other sharing of what you explored in the week? Learning, insight? Yeah, Patty.
Following up on what Deborah said, I find it interesting to watch how I am receiving generosity toward me. And I'm not as gracious as I would hope to be, because I like to see myself as the helper and giver and the doer, not the recipient.
Yeah.
So it's humbling to realize that we're always both in both roles.
Great. Yeah.
And with the diagnosis that's scary, people just come out of the woodwork to try to be comforting.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to take it in is a challenge,
mm-hmm.
because you just want to push it away.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, it's my practice to try to see the generosity in what others are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's not intended as generosity, but it's generosity.
Mm-hmm.
People are helping all the time,
mm-hmm.
and they don't see it, that they're practicing generosity, but if I can frame it that way and see, oh my God, that's a great act of generosity,
mm-hmm.
it's really refreshing and calming to me to see how much generosity is out in the world, even though those people may not label it as such.
Mm-hmm.
There are kindnesses everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and I love looking for them because it helps motivate me to act kind in turn.
Yeah, thank you, that's great. And what that sparks in me is, again, something that I've just really gotten a little more clarity on in developing these thoughts on generosity, that it's really a practice which has potential to really give us or move us towards a much deeper sense of interdependence, you know, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, which is such a, a crucial insight for our lives. So, because again, the conditioning in the culture is to, I'm here, you're there, we're separate, and so forth. And this goes against that. And in that sense, it goes against the delusion of being apart, which we're not really, but we get in that frame often. And so, that taking generosity and gratitude as practices to help us really, in that sense, deepen the wisdom dimension of really living more in that sense of interdependence. That's something I've learned a little more in exploring this, you know, that I wasn't so clear on before.
I was just thinking, in terms of the conversation we were having, that there's a certain element that, we have difficulty receiving when we're not in crisis.
Yeah.
So when we have that hard moment, is often the moment we open up and allow others to give to us. And I had that happen recently for me, and I realized that I was blocking a flow by trying to be so self-reliant all the time.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have opened if the hard thing wouldn't
That's great. Yeah, it really complements Patty's point that, and really points to that we can, if any of those two tendencies that Patty mentioned, that you mentioned, are true, we can really, when someone thanks us, we can just not say, oh, nothing. Right? We can actually, can we take it in? Mm-hmm. Right? And then can we see if we are, you know, trying to be this self-reliant one in ways that, in a sense, obviously there's good qualities there, but maybe take us away from that sense of interdependence, or that we can modify it some, as you did. Yeah. Thanks. Maybe one more, and then we'll have the meta cards.
I lived in San Francisco in the 1989 earthquake, and it was almost as if we were all leveled. The same, we were all the same. We had no power. I had no transportation. I mean, it was. I just saw that something deep had happened with the impact of the earthquake. There was no litter. There was no loiter. No
looting.
No looting. And it was amazing to me. I've never forgotten that. But it was like, we had no power, we had nothing. And everybody, and no contact except with what was in front of me. It all worked out. And this people talking about crisis, it just put us in a place where we had to just be. And we were all in it. We didn't know each other, but we were all in the same place. And that, it was just, we all needed each other. We all helped each other, but we didn't know each other. No, it was amazing to me.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Bring it up.
Thank you.